Want to know one of my secrets for doing a great show or having a great performance? And that is being comfortable. And it starts with your underwear. I know it sounds weird, but it's true. And that is what I love about MeUndies. They are comfortable right when you put them on. And when you feel good, forget it. Anything is possible on stage and in life. And their naturally soft fiber makes a fabric that won't sag down or ride up. Trust me. Once you put on a pair, you'll forget you even have them on. I have them on right now, and I'm like, oh my God, did I wear underwear? Oh, no. They're so comfortable. I'm wearing a pair of MeUndies. And I'm so happy how MeUndies make me feel that I'm personally endorsing them. And MeUndies is sure that you'll love them as much as I do, that if you're not happy with your first pair, they will do whatever they can to get you into the right pair. And for whatever reason they can't, keep them and they'll refund you. So it's really risk-free to try the best underwear ever. And if you're still not sure, well, MeUndies has a deal for you improv nerd listeners. First time purchase gets 15% off their first pair of MeUndies and free shipping. That's 15% off plus free shipping and a guarantee that you and your MeUndies will be very happy together. So get your butt over to MeUndies.com and take the first step to being comfortable in your life and on stage. To get your 15% off your first pair, free shipping, and a 100% satisfaction guarantee, go to MeUndies.com/improv nerd. That's MeUndies.com/improv nerd. Since I've been brushing my teeth with a Quip electric toothbrush, I'm brushing my teeth more often and I'm really enjoying it because Quip makes it so easy and so fun because the brush does all the work for you. And unlike those big, bulky electric toothbrushes, Quip is just a fraction of the cost. And here's one of my favorite features about Quip. They have a built-in timer to help you clean your teeth for the dentist recommended 2 minutes. And if you sign up for Quip's subscription plan, they will deliver new brush heads to you every 3 months for just $5, including shipping worldwide. And finally, everyone loves Quip. Not only me, they were on Oprah's O-List. They were named one of Time's best inventions. And it is the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association. Quip just starts at $25, and if you go to getquip.com/nerd right now, you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/nerd, spelled getquip.com/nerd.
Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Oh,
hey everybody, this is Jimmy Crane, and you're listening to another great episode of Improv Nerd. Our guest today is Shad Kunkel. He is an actor, improviser, teacher, corporate trainer using improv, comedian. He has performed with the Herald team, Carl and the Passions, where I got to play with him for a couple of years, at the I.O. Chicago. He has been with that team for 20 years. He also toured with the Second City National Touring Company and understudied the Second City Main Stage. We talked to him about the importance of focusing on the other person when you're improvising. Also, he gave us great tips about coaching and directing improvisation. He talked to us about active listening and how that's so important in improvisation. And of course, we went down memory lane talking about jealousy and famous people, I think. We might have name-dropped one or two people in this episode that we both got to work with. You're going to love this episode. He gives you some exercises, too, that he's used in class. And he's one of my favorite people. I always enjoyed working with Shad and enjoyed not only working with him on stage, but also talking with him before and after. I don't know why, but we always seem to connect. Before we get to the episode with Shad, I want to say this because I kind of feel like a proud dad. My daughter is very creative, and let me just share what happened the other day at our house to prove this point to you. So Lauren said to Betsy had one rice cake she had gotten out of the pantry, and Lauren said, you can only have one rice cake at a time, because Lauren didn't want her to go into getting another rice cake unless she finished eating it. So then Lauren got me involved and said, what should we do here? Should we set this boundary? And I said, sure, let's set the boundary. Betsy, you can only have one rice cake at a time. Well, of course she cried because she wanted to play with two rice cakes. And she cried and she cried. And then this is where the brilliance comes in. She turns around and she heads towards the garbage can. And she opens the garbage can lid and she drops the rice cake into the garbage can. So now she has no rice cakes. And so now she moves into the pantry to get another rice cake because we had set up the rule, right, that you can only have one rice cake at a time. So she grabs herself another rice cake and then goes back to the garbage can and fishes out the rice cake that she threw in the garbage can. And now she has two rice cakes that she's banging together and saying, two, 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 two. And both her parents were not only proud of her, but also kind of felt stupid for setting that boundary. All right, enough about me. You're going to love this phone interview we did with Shad Kunkel. He is so thoughtful about improvisation, and especially love what he talks about being a director and a coach of improv. Here it is, the Shad Kunkel episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
Shad Kunkel, thank you so much for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
Well, thanks for having me, Jimmy. This is a good time.
Yes, and to be perfectly honest with our audience, we recorded the original episode, and for whatever reason, I screwed it up, and we didn't record it. So this is technically our second time we're doing this. So I just want to say thank you so much for making time to do this on a Sunday morning.
And it's really a shame because we got into some heated political arguments. There was some yelling back and forth. We really went through and then we made up.
Yeah.
It was a pretty intense session.
And I think we resolved some stuff when we played together on Carl that
yeah.
there was some misunderstanding. I think there was some jealousy that had never been
yeah.
communicated. And, but that's lost now.
That's lost now. You listed, remember, because I listed off all the alumni of Carl and I forgot to list your name. And then you went after me about it
yeah.
For about 25 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah. But here's the thing. The audience doesn't get to hear that. But I think they can hear it in our voices, the healing that we've made in our relationship.
The redemption
yeah.
that we're on the other side of. Let's see what pops up next.
All right. So you grew up in Fairfield, Iowa, and your dad worked in an iron foundry and your mom was a music teacher. And you told me that you were a big kid, I think a lanky kid who did a lot of sports. And the way you kind of compensated for not being that good in sports is you would be the funny one. You developed your sense of humor. Do you remember that specific time where it's like it all clicked in? It's like you were making fun of yourself and you got that validation?
Oh, boy. I can't remember the specific time. I remember being called lanky in every single critique of any show that I ever did. I remember being like, what's that word lanky? I don't like it. It's interesting. I can't remember any like specific time when it all clicked in as much as it was just kind of always there to deflect and hide the fact that I was just terrified of the fact that I wasn't coordinated enough, to be out there. And I played, you know, sports forever. And I definitely got out onto the court and got out onto the field. And I was actively used as a player quite a bit, but there was just this level of insecurity you had about being a little bit slower and incapable compared to the other guy. And I just remember being, you know, using comedy to deflect. There was one time I'll never forget with my team. It was a basketball team. And I knew that like, in basketball, it was like I was a tall guy for the floor, but I really couldn't do anything else. And my team was all sick and they were all nauseous. And my coach kept checking in with everybody. And I could tell that he kind of had to check in with me. But he went through the team and he was like, how are you doing, Matt? How are you doing, Shannon? How are you doing, Brent? And everyone was like, not very good, not doing great. It's been a real hard week and blah, blah, blah. And he came to Shad. How you doing, Shad? And I was like, I'm doing great, coach. Just as kind of a, I know you don't give a crap. So I think it's hilarious that I would be your best functioning soldier right now. And I think that was kind of the root of it. You know, this way of like bringing attention to yourself when you know that nobody really cares.
Were you kind of a smartass? Because that's almost kind of a smartass thing to do.
I was from time to time. Yeah, I was definitely, but never like maliciously. Only when there was a situation where, hold on just a second, Jimmy.
Okay.
I've got an electric car driving by me here.
For our listeners, you are out on a porch in a suburb of Chicago, taking this phone call on a Sunday morning.
That is correct. Yes, I am recording on this out here on this podcast on a Sunday morning outdoors because it's the only place that we can get good reception.
And if
But
you hear things in the background, that sounds like a playground and birds. Is that right?
that's right. That's right. Most of my time is spent in suburban playgrounds. It's just a really fun place to hang out, and there's always policemen nearby watching me. So in case anything happens, I've got support right there. Back to the question, I was a bit of a smart ass from time to time. I think my heroes were Han Solo, Harrison Ford, and Bill Murray in Stripes. And those guys were always kind of smart asses. So I think it carried over.
And after going to Simpson College, which is a small liberal arts college in Iowa, where you were in a fraternity, which always kind of surprises me, and you never drank, you then moved to Chicago in Evanston, which is a suburb here, and you study at the Piven Theater with a guy named Bernie Beck. And the Piven Theater had people like Joan and John Cusack and Jeremy Piven and Aidan Quinn were alumni. And you studied there and take us back to that first class that you were in with Bernie Beck.
Yeah, it was crazy because I was terrified that I was about to do improv, and improv scared me. And I thought for sure it was going to be like full of risks. I thought people were going to ask us to, because the scene demanded it, we were all going to have to get naked and do Shakespeare. I just had no idea what I was doing, and I was terrified.
That
And
game
I remember.
is out, by the way.
Oh, it is. It's out.
I think it was in 98 it was outlawed. Yeah.
Okay, well, it's funny because Meisner's still in there, and
Right.
students are still like mi mirroring each other until they make out. So I don't understand why Naked Shakespeare is out.
What was this that you started?
So what's that?
What year was it when you took the class at Piven?
Okay, so let's do the math. Graduated college in '96. It took me, I want to say '98,
Okay.
because I got a job, but then I did the job for a year, terrified to go to class next door. And finally summoned up the courage, like a New Year's resolution, took the class, and I just remember he started talking about the way the mind operates when it's improvising and how we find creativity through necessity. And that really worked for me. I didn't like it when people were just creative for creative sake. I loved it when people reacted to situations that were happening in front of them. He talked a lot about Michael Jordan and how he would approach the basketball, and he'd go up with the right hand and somebody would come in to block. And it wasn't that he was trying to show off, but he would switch to the left hand and come up underneath the hoop out of necessity to get there. And that really worked with me. And then I remember there was an exercise where he asked us as a group to move an object from one side of the room to the other. And if it ever failed to keep its reality, it's as an object, if all of a sudden, if the shape of it moved or wasn't believable, we had to go back and start from the beginning and move it again. And I remember moving a refrigerator, and I was working with two other students, and you could see as we tipped the refrigerator back, because this woman had a dolly, that the refrigerator was too big and it was going to crush her. And it was just this moment where we all kind of realized it together. So we scooted it without leaning, tipping it back across the floor. And I remember getting done, and my legs were just burning on fire, and I was covered in sweat, like I had moved an actual refrigerator. And I thought, what a crazy thing to be able to trick the mind into like getting a workout. And so every day, that's what I do. I do 20 jumping jacks in my mind and keep myself in shape and live forever.
And then after you take, I think you take a couple classes at Piven, you move to the city, you move to Chicago, and then you take some classes at the Players Workshop for a couple levels, the Second City Conservatory where you graduate, and IO Chicago. And for the last 20 years, you play on a team called Carl and the Passions. Now, anyone doesn't know, this is one of the, I mean, it's a great Herald team. And I was lucky enough to be on that team. But when you started 20 years ago, I mean, it had people like
Noah Gregoropoulos, TJ Jagodowski, Jack McBrayer, Bob Dassey, Craig Kakowski. I mean, these were, I don't know if John Lutz was on there then, was he?
He was. Okay. Well, yeah, he was on there.
And you're put on that team 20 years ago, taken from one of Noah's classes. So you're a student, then thrown on Carl and the Passion with these A-list, seasoned, excellent improvisers. How do you deal with the intimidation factor?
That's a tough one, and I'm still working with it 20 years later. At the time, it was an honor, and it's such an interesting thing because it was an experiment, and I'm not so sure everyone was totally on board, especially at first. I think, some of those veteran players were like, all right, I'll play on the team if you ask me, and I think that they were doing it because Noah really wanted a team and he was bouncing around from team to team. And so he decided to make a team that was in the spirit of Noah, which is that he likes to experiment. He doesn't like it when things are all polished and smooth and cool. He likes it when people have to react to circumstances and operate around challenges. And it was certainly a challenge. I know that I had a really hard time keeping up when it first started. And it was tough because you kind of had to get out of the way of other players because those other players were going to be your stars. Your TJ Jagodowskis, your Paul Grandis, your Craig Kakowskis, they were all going to be the players that were probably going to carry the scene. You just didn't want to look like the person who was bringing the scene down. And so it meant that I had to play from a point of what can I just do to help? And that changes your approach. You know, I think a lot of people get into this business because they want to get noticed. They want to be the Kate McKinnon who gets noticed as the big character actor and can carry scene after scene after scene. And it's not always about that. Sometimes it's about just making the team look good. And it was tough because for years, I don't know that I did make the team look good. I think for a while there, it was just our pros kind of carrying us. And, other people kind of struggling from behind. And I think there were other players, too, who saw that and thought, well, that team is probably, it's a waste to have particular players on there. They might as well just throw more all-stars on there. But I think the beauty of Carl, and it's consistent to do this for the last 20 years, is that we find new people and we try to show them the ropes. And the idea behind it is that, this is a skill to pass down. This is an art form to share with the new people coming up. And I think that's the spirit behind Carl.
You know, a lot of people, and it's certainly something that I still struggle with, when they start out, people want to be the funniest. They want to be the standout. What made you a better player working with, much more experienced people at the time?
Well, I couldn't be a standout, that's for sure. So I had to do something else. And teams are made up of ensembles. They're made up of multiple people setting people up. And, you think of Chris Farley. Chris Farley was amazing. And then you've got, imagine if you had six Chris Farleys on a team. It just wouldn't work. You'd destroy the stage. You'd destroy the theater. So sometimes you got to play different roles. And I would say that in that experience, I had to carry some scenes. I had to try and, if one scene was really good because we had TJ in it and the next scene was just really terrible because I was in it, that didn't play well for the show. So there were times when I would notice, like, did TJ or Paul, did they play like a low energy scene? Well, then I'll pick up the energy. Or it was really about the fact that, like, it's not even about who's the better player. It's about changing up the energy from scene to scene. And I would watch what they would do and I would try to a different energy and take it a different direction. So that's one of the skill sets I learned was about energy manipulation in the scene. It's just like a great album has like a really fast song and then a slow song and then a fun song and then a dark song. It's the same thing. And it doesn't matter whether they're a better player or you, your responsibility is for the song that you're playing at the time.
You talk a lot about being other focused, and it sounds like here this is where you kind of learn to be other focused, focusing on the other person. How does that free you up creatively?
Well, the best part about being others focused is that if you're acting in service of somebody else, sometimes you let go of that judgment and hesitation that's in your own head. So if I'm acting in service of just trying to make the show be okay, If now, if I'm acting out of a place of fear, I'm going to fall right into the bad patterns that got me into a problem in the first place. But if I'm acting in service of where the scene needs me to be, what will complete this picture, then that shuts down, you know, that puts you more in your creative part of your brain and shuts down the fear and hesitation part of your brain. And so, you know, you say others focus, people think, oh, you got to be a martyr, you got to just support everybody else and play for everybody else. But the truth is, the practice of focusing on something other than yourself is where you find creativity. And you know, for years, I also was kind of dominated by fear. And after a while, I realized that fear got in the way of me being able to be others focused. And so eventually I let go of that fear. And it wasn't just because I wasn't currently afraid. It was just that the scene needed me to have more courage. The team needed me to have more courage. And I found that after I realized that it's my job is to be of service to this show, to be of service to this scene, not to sit back here and worry about me. That's selfish. My hesitation is selfish.
And by doing that, are there nights where you do stand out?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And you never really know. It's like hitting a home run, you know, it, when it comes off the bat, it feels like nothing. It feels like you didn't even swing. Yeah, on those days where like you hit a really good scene or something like that, you don't even know, you know, it feels like you don't even know why, but that's because the choices you made to put yourself there were actually simple. People think it's hard and complex, and it's not. It's about recognizing where you need to be at the time and then throwing yourself into it. And the more you have success, the more, you know, you have fun with that. But it's about identifying that moment and throwing yourself into it. And I absolutely have had some standout scenes. I mean, it's been 20 years and they haven't cut me yet, Jimmy. I mean, it's not that they won't, but there's always a chance.
Were you ever afraid? Because that's always one of my fears when I get on a really good team or get a really good opportunity. It's like in the back of my head, I'm like, okay, when are they going to fire me? When are they going to cut me from the team?
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing that I realized is that, I mean, life is tricky because we have all these things that we want, these expectations and stuff. But in our field and what we do in this art form, so much of what we do is beyond our control. And to worry about it is kind of insane. The more time we spend worrying about things we can't control, that's just worry for worry's sake. And so all you can really do is in the moment be of service to that. And I've found that, like, when teams do get cut and things do happen, it's not always terrible because, you know, it just means you're about to go explore your next opportunity. And we have this set agenda in our mind of what our careers need to be, where we need to be, who we need to be. And that's not the spirit of improv. The spirit of improv is to be flexible and adaptive to where the next thing takes you, even if it's not improv, even if it's you're going to stop doing improv and you're going to go into a medical field, or you're going to go and, you know, work in another company. This ability to adapt and find happiness is part of the art form. But whenever we worry about things we can't control, we're really not living in the spirit of improv. So I try not to do that.
How do you deal with it? You know, I love talking about jealousy because I'm like it's so the funny. Most jealous person you're going to know. But how do you deal with, and you know, I got a name drop here, you know, people that you worked with, Jason Sudeikis, Peter Gross, we named Jack McBrayer. Jordan Klepper. We both got
Jenny
to work
Hagel.
Jenny Hagel, who writes for Seth Meyers. How do you, when you know, here you are and here I am, we're in Chicago, how do you deal when these people become really successful and really famous?
Yeah, it's a tricky one, right? Because you, for some reason, put their achievements against your own and you compare and then you get sad. But at the same time, you know, TJ Jagodowski told me this and I believe this. He's like, you know, the first thing he said is there's enough room for everybody. There's enough room for everybody. Everyone wants to go out there and be an artist. There's room for you. It's not because somebody took your spot. There's another spot, you know, that can open up. And then there's enough room for everybody, and somebody else's accomplishment is not your failure. And sometimes we think like this, and it really doesn't make any sense that because the person next to you was successful. Now all of a sudden, your lack of success is a failure. Their success is just reflective of the fact that they spent time with you on the way up. That's a hard thing to see. But, you know, the pursuit of life isn't about fame or glory or even having a bunch of level one students talk about how you may or may not be the funniest person on NBC. That's not happiness. The pursuit of life is about happiness. So you have to find out what is a good fit for you and what you're willing to throw your attention to in and what avoids the depression demons that come with being alone from time to time with yourself. And I look at those guys as being successful and I'm real happy for them. My biggest complaint isn't that I wasn't successful. My biggest complaint is that I just don't get to see them anymore. And that's the real heartbreak for me is you make all these friends that are really cool people and other people notice it too. And then the fame monster takes your friends away and you're kind of like, wait, no, that was my friend first. And then you go to the Annoyance Theater and Jason Sudeikis is supposed to be there. And you go, hey, is Jason Sudeikis here? And somebody looks at you and goes, oh yeah, he was asking about you. He really wants to know if you're here too. And you realize they're being sarcastic because they think you don't possibly know this guy. And you're like, well, screw you, buddy. I do know that guy. I went to his wedding. I know this guy. But nobody believes it anymore because you're not famous. That's the heartbreak of it. Those are the moments where you're kind of like, I wish I was famous just to get some asshole in front of me out of my way. But that wasn't in the cards for me. I was the Forrest Gump of improv. I was going to be running through everyone else's famous career and get to see a little part of it. And that's okay too.
And also when you were at the IO, you coached the Reckoning, which was an amazing Herald team. And, I think coaching improv is probably one of the most thankless jobs there is out there. And you did this for 10 years. And you said to me, the most important thing about coaching is it's not about the coach. It's about the team. Can you explain that?
Yeah, absolutely. The Reckoning was an ambitious team. And when it started, it was a lot of, you know, everyone always remembers the Reckoning as being like, well, it was this all-star team that was made up. They were going to be good no matter what. There were some people out there that had been, recognized, but there weren't, you know, it really wasn't an all-star team at that point. There were a few all-stars. Brad Morris was an all-star at the time. People knew Brad to be really funny. Pat O'Brien, which we call P.O.B., but Michael O'Brien, I guess, is his real name. I don't even know who he is anymore.
Right.
Were good. Jake Schneider had some success with the team. But they weren't necessarily like asked to be on Armando or anything like that. They were just, some faces coming up. And then there were two people we picked up that were coming out of level five that weren't even put on teams, that were based on a suggestion by Holly Laurent. Sharna will kill me. She always says I created the Reckoning. I saw every person and she did, but there was definitely some, we need two more players. Let's get these two people and get permission from Sharna to be cool. And the two people we picked up out of a level five team was Brian Jack, who was really doing well at the team, and a quieter guy that Holly Laurent said he's pretty good, though, and is Charlie McCracken. And now Charlie McCracken, you know, is on AP Bio playing the coach. He's one of the funniest guys out there. And he was real quiet when we first started out. But together as a team, they decided that they were going to let me coach them. And that's an interesting thing because we try to oversteer. We try to overmanage. We try to make it about us. And the truth is that, you know, teams are doers and coaches are tellers. And if you overtell the doers what to do, you don't let them discover for themselves. And one of the great blessings at the time was that Michael O'Brien was about, you know, I think he had graduated from IO classes about a year after me. And for me to be his coach was kind of an interesting thing because I wasn't too much his senior. But he said he let me be the voice piece for them. And being the voice piece for them, it wasn't about me. It was about just being the focal point so that when everybody wasn't talking over each other at one point. And a lot of the things that I did was I took a lot of the lessons that I was learning from Carl and the Passions, a lot of the ideas, and just gave them something to focus on from time to time. Improv isn't about knowing all the answers and building it up as a perfect model. It's about giving people something to focus on from week to week so that they themselves find fresh new paths to walk. And if you try to take ownership or credit for that, you're taking away what you want, which is for them to take their own ownership of the idea. So you, much like a loving parent, you don't want to have a child grow up and then spend the whole time standing in front of that parent saying, hey, this is about me. Did you see, this person's a really good football player and I coached him on that. So this is about me. It's not about you. The whole point is you want these people to go off and survive in the wilderness on their own. And so what I did was I just felt a lot of gratitude from Carl and the Passions asking a nobody first starting out to play with them. And I tried to pass on that gratitude by just giving them the information that they gave me. And at one point in time, they started working with TJ Jagodowski. So they were having like two coaches a week. And a lot of people were like, well, does that make you upset that they're working with another coach? And I was like, of course it doesn't make me upset. Are you kidding me? Getting to play with one of the greatest improvisers of all time once a week? Go for it, guys. Do you still want to meet with me? And they were like, yeah. I was like, okay, then do you want to do both? And they were like, yeah. But that jealousy that comes from my identity is more important than their progress is what gets you, is what makes it about you. And then then you're an obstacle in the way of your own goal, which is to coach this team. It's not about you. It's about them just having somebody to lean on when they need you.
Would the tip be, what tip would you give somebody for coaching? You know, because people that listen to this listen from all parts of the world. What is there a practical tip? I mean, like shut your mouth or, you know, like just let them talk? Or is there a practical tip that they can use coaching or directing improv that's worked for you?
Well, there's a mantra that I used to have everybody repeat at the end of my level three class that I taught. I'm trying to remember it because it's been a while since I taught level three. And I would always have them say, I will not try to do things. I will simply ask myself to do things. The result of those things will be neither good nor bad. They will simply be. And I used to have the class repeat that. And the idea behind it is that we have to just ask ourselves to do things. We have to let ourselves do things, not make ourselves do things. And as coaches, there is a simple study in that you have to just, you have to present it out there as an option for them. And then they have to choose it. And giving them ideas and opportunities. And it's when they start going, you need to tell me what to do, instead of letting them, instead of going, thank you for the options, coach, we're going to choose to go with this one. It's when they start demanding to be told what to do all the time, which is when they're leaning on you too much, like a parent that needs to take care of them. And that's usually when teams don't make it to that next level, which is to take ownership and do their own thing. But you have to just, it's a hands-off approach, and you have to monitor it situation by situation. So you have to ask them to do things, but not make them do things. That would be my advice.
Some of my best coaching, teaching, directing sessions have been where I say very little, and I just get them up there playing.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a part of level three that I used to coach, which was all on energy matching. And I got this as well from some of my teachers growing up who used to do this. But I would just walk into the theater at the start about 2 or 3 minutes before we were supposed to start. And I would just play music. And I would say, your warm up is to dance. And they would just get up there and they would just start dancing. And then as people came in, they were given a choice. When they walked in, they would be like, well, I could sit here and wait for class to start and find my instructions, or I could put my bag down and just get up there and dance with everybody else. And the idea behind it was, and we would do three songs, and the idea behind it was that just join the dance. just join the dance. That's what the lesson was for the day, which was that when you walk into a scene, you've got in your mind all these ideas of places it could go, characters you want to play, things that you want to take from the opening to explore. And the truth is that there's an energy out there happening, and that's the thing you got to join. Join the dance, whether it's a person's character, whether it's a game of scene, whatever it is, you just need to step out there and keep it simple and join the thing that's happening in front of you and explore that.
You know what I love about that? And by the way, I tried that yesterday in one of my intensives.
Just by yourself in a room?
Yeah, yeah.
And no one came and joined you and danced?
Yeah, yeah. Because Noah, you know, he's always, like you said, about experimenting. And that guy embraces failure. I mean, he
does.
You know, I wish I had that in me. But what I love about how you described that game was that when people walk in late, I find a lot of times students, and I was the same way, they're looking for permission from the teacher or the director or the coach
to participate.
And it's like, you just get, you know, you're saying, just join the dance. You don't need my approval. You don't need me to say it's okay to do it. Can you, that to me is trusting your instincts.
Yeah. I mean, these coaches and teachers are supposed to be inspiration. They're not supposed to be dictators. And we spend so much time feeling like, well, we can't do this without so-and-so. Well, that's going to be a real problem, because so-and-so is not going to be there as your coach or director every single time you perform. This isn't about your relationship with them. This is about your relationship with giving yourself permission. And honestly, it's about quieting the judge in your brain. There's a part of your brain that taught you how to walk before you knew that you were clumsy. There was a part of your brain that taught you how to talk before you knew that you were stupid. And it's a natural, organic part of your brain. And it will naturally know what to do in situations. It's when we get older and that part of your brain that is the judge steps in and goes, no, we need to do this. We need to do that. We need to make things happen. That judge gets in the way of your natural, organic learning process. And so that's why it's so much harder to teach, quote unquote, an old dog new tricks, because the old dog is set in its ways with the decisions that it made in its mind. We have to let go of those decisions. We have to put those aside and play the scene we're in. And so great players don't necessarily wait for their teachers to give them permission to do stuff. Now, that being said, you don't need to take unnecessary risks. Removing judgment does not mean letting go of ignoring errors. Errors are still out there. If you're in level one, don't go out there and do a scene about racism. That's a terrible idea. Don't do a scene about things you don't know because you have an idea that that's what you should do a scene about. Play the scene you're in, play the reality you're in at the time. But that simplifying to get to that is the hardest thing to do, because you have to quiet so much of your brain in order to be present in that moment. And the best way to do it is through tons and tons of reps. Because after 20 years of playing with the Carl and the Passions, as I'll call them right now, I eventually got to a spot where, you know, sometimes when I'm in a scene, it goes well because I brought the energy that the show needed at the time. And I played off of that.
We got to take a quick break here, and then we'll be right back after this.
In the Artist Loc Comedy Summer Weekend Intensives, I want to give you some tools that will help you take your improv to the next level. Now, if you've been around, you've been improvising for a while, you may feel like you're in a rut, like you're doing the same scenes over and over and over again. Or you just are like, I want to get inspired again. I want to get excited about improv like when I first started. I think when we've been improvising for a while, we make it harder than it needs to be. We put added pressure that we don't need to put on ourselves. And in the Artist Loc Comedy Summer Weekend Intensive, I want to make improv for you as easy as having a conversation. In the Artist Loc Comedy Weekend Summer Intensive, you'll learn to slow down and shut up so you can start using your feelings to create all you need for your scene work. Also, you'll learn before you can be funny, you need to be real. And guess what? You're going to be even funnier in a more genuine and honest way. And I get it. Not everybody wants to improvise this way. I'm not going to take it personally. And if you are interested in working this way, I will be offering 2 summer weekend intensives on the weekend of July 28th and 29th and August 11th and 12th right here in Chicago. To register or for more information, go to my website at jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com. I'd love to work with you.
The thing that I loved playing about in Carl was playing with you and Carl was that besides talking before, you always got me up to date on what was going on in the improv community. That was kind of our warm up. And then you always would step out and you would be very, you get a laugh at the top of the scene. You brought either an emotional energy or some sort of physicality. How much, because you studied in comedy sports in 2008 after you had been established as a long form player, how much of that stepping out, having something automatically, either an emotion or an energy, was something you learned at comedy sports?
Oh, so much of it. I mean, you have to come out there and just and do something interesting right away. Comedy sports, of course, you know, teaches you to act differently than you feel. You know, you have so much time. We don't have time for you to find it. You got to go out there and create it. And it also just reminds you that the audience is rooting for you. So take a swing, put some energy into it. Maybe I learned a lot from just like, they play so much with different genres and different options that when I step in to do an opening move, I have a lot of memories of different things in there. And I have a lot of ideas, but another piece of advice though that I got, which was from Carl again, was just start something like it's happening in the middle. You know, you think about great movies you've seen and it starts off with like a person looking over their shoulder and a gunshot goes off and blackness. And you're like, oh, now I'm intrigued. That's the hook. And comedy sports has to hook you really fast. They got to get your attention quickly in that scene, because it's going to be done in about 3 minutes and 15 seconds. And there's no reason we can't do that in other things in our life. Media does it. They hook us all the time. They give you an article that says, woman finds out her breast is a starfish. And you're like, I got to learn more about that. Are you kidding me? I mean, and then you dig in more. The opening scene is a hook to get everybody going. And so if you just think through, like, what's the thing I can say that makes you want to click for more. And that's kind of how I go about those initiation scenes. How can this line be an invitation to want to keep watching? Yeah, for sure. Comedy sports taught me that, but also just the philosophy of how do you keep people's attention? Because I'm used to being ignored until that opening line of a scene. And it's usually my way of getting people's attention. So it's kind of a smart ass move to some degree. But most of the time when you come to see a Carl and the Passion show, especially when I was going through, you weren't there to see Shad Kunkel. You were there to see these landmark veterans that had been coming up for years. And so this was my way of saying, hey, guess what? I'm here too. And I had to get you from the opening line.
So if I threw out the theme chocolate for you and you're doing a Carl show, what would your first, what would you be thinking in terms of making an initiation for that first scene?
Jesus, Wonka, you've taken it too far. That's the first thing that comes to the top of my head. Chocolate. Willy Wonka. What if Willy Wonka was just out of control, and now all of a sudden I've forced someone in the scene to play Willy Wonka, which is fine, because Willy Wonka is really open to interpretation.
Right, and yeah. I could play him drunk, right?
Yeah, you could do whatever you want to.
I'd be like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, exactly. So now we've got fun, because when I think of chocolate, I think of exploring a world, and the most fun world to explore that's also familiar with everybody else is Willy Wonka. And so that's the first thing that comes to my head. But now all of a sudden we're asking the question, what did you do, Willy Wonka? And just the fact that we're going to say the name Willy Wonka a number of times is funny, because Willy Wonka is a stupid name. It's a great name, but it's also ridiculous. And the idea that we would be, you know, looking at the dark side of what is a children's story that already kind of has a dark side, and seeing what really was going on there.
And I'm just thinking, like, I could just play the most pathetic Willy Wonka. Like, I don't even like children.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm diabetic. I haven't had chocolate since I was 4.
Yeah, I'm diabetic.
Yeah.
All this stuff that, like, that's just the first thing that comes to my mind. There needs to be a hook. You know, I usually word associate off of, you know, what does chocolate make me think of? And I live in a very nerdy world. Like, I definitely, I'm a big comic book fan. I'm a big fan of everything that comes out in the nerd world. And so I love the heightening of the stakes that comes from sci-fi and nerd stuff. You know, like Battlestar Galactica was a show where everyone was talking about their emotions, and the backdrop was that we could all die at any time, and it just raised the stakes of everything around it. And so when I improvise, I try to raise the stakes through our narrative somehow, some way, in order to give it for people to care about what happens.
So how did you get, so you got chocolate, how did you get to Willy Wonka if you were word association?
Because Wonka's the guy who made the chocolate stream, who made the, you know, the fantasy world of the Oompa Loompas. Mm-hmm. And so I went to Wonka just because I believe the suggestion was chocolate. And it was just a quick fix for me because that's a human being connected to chocolate. Because it can't just be about, you know, chocolate. If Wonka hadn't come to my mind, I probably would have done something a little less effective, like your father wanted me to give this to you from the war. It was a chocolate bar from Vietnam. It was given to him by another prisoner because the other prisoner knew he was going to die. And he held on to this chocolate bar. And instead of eating it for himself for one last pleasure, one last piece, moment of joy, he decided he wanted to pass that on to his son because that was why he was living in the first place. And just give it stakes, you know, that's the first thing that comes to the top of my mind is making something unimportant important. And the best way to make it important is make it important to people.
So let me talk to you about the two initiations you just made off chocolate. One is you put an emotion behind the, you know, the Willy Wonka, you know, line.
Yeah.
And also, I remember early on this when I was at the IO, someone had made me Picasso, and I regret this to this day, but I shut down when somebody made me Picasso. And now I know I would have just been, you know, I would have played Pablo Picasso the best I could, right?
Uh-huh. But,
so for people that are listening and going like, well, I don't really want to label somebody, that's kind of steamrolling. How do you respond to that?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, if I ever said, Jesus, Wonka, what have you done? There are times when I'll initiate that line mm-hmm. to no one else on the stage. And so what'll happen is I'll just walk over, look at something to the side and say, Jesus, Wonka, you've taken it too far or whatever it is. Thus knowing full well that whoever steps onto the stage with me has chosen to absorb that role. And if they really don't feel comfortable with it, they won't do it. I also, there's a big difference between picking Willy Wonka and Oprah. Oprah is somebody we all know. We can't fake Oprah. And if you do, it's a really bad impression. Wonka, it was played, of course, in the movie. It's been played by several people. But Wonka is more of an idea. Wonka gives us permission to be multiple people. Whereas, you know, Picasso is also all about abstract. So in both of those cases, if somebody says you're Pablo Picasso and you're Willy Wonka, we're not fighting like a memory of that person as much, right? Even if somebody says you're Trump, well, now you have to do all the mannerisms that Trump does. You have to say the things. You're being held to a comparison of an impression. But we can take a lot of artistic liberties with people who aren't as well defined. So I don't, and once again, I won't always just point at somebody and say, hey, you're Prince, unless I'm really having fun with somebody and it's just a fun way to start a scene. Like I've definitely had Katie Rich do that to me where she just says, hey, Mayor Bumblebutt. And you're like, oh, I guess I got to play Mayor Bumblebutt now. You know, and if you know that somebody's in their head, don't put them in a spot where they think that there's boundaries around what they can and can't do. But there's no rules out there. And if you're forced to have to play someone, the audience is going to be on your side anyway, because they're thinking to themselves, they're not judging you thinking, well, you better have a pretty good Willy Wonka impression here. They're thinking, ooh, what a tough spot. How are you going to navigate out of this? And then, but it also is tricky. Yeah, you don't want to pick somebody who everyone, like a Christopher Walken, where it's like, now you got to do the voice. Go ahead.
So then let's talk about the other initiation, which is almost like a monologue. The one you were talking about you know, your dad, you know, gave this candy bar from Vietnam and all that stuff. That, to me, people would say, well, we're supposed to just do one word at a time, one line at a time when we initiate.
Well, in this initiation, of course, we weren't technically improvising because you were, you know, it's a phone interview. So I was just giving you more information because I could. In that scene, I might have that in my head, but I may not walk out and start in on something. But if I hit it with a theme and an energy and you can tell that I'm about to do something that's familiar, like a long-winded explanation of this. A lot of times a good improviser on the other end will go, oh, no, please go on. Tell me more. It sounds like you've got a backstory here. And then we get that fun story of them having to improvise on top of improvising. And you have to read the moment over and over again, right? You can't just steamroll something. You have to be open to being interrupted so that you don't keep going with that. But you know, in this case, I know that you're going to let me go because we're doing a podcast. But if I was on that stage, I might just start off with something as simple as, I've brought you something from your father who passed away in Vietnam. It's chocolate. And, you know, maybe give them a chance to react. And if they, you know, I have an idea in my mind what it is, just as a person who walked into that moment would. And they'd be like, is it the kind of chocolate you get at the airport? No. Well, yes, actually, it is that kind of chocolate. But it has a special meaning to your father. And then now we can start it and then create a dialogue. Tell me more. So that's how I would get there. But like, you know, if I know that, like in this podcast, I'm just going to have to give you that information right now. I'll go with it in the moment. I'll play it piece line by line and piece by piece.
Also, the thing that I love playing about you is you were a great, great listener. And you gave me an exercise, and I tried this Wednesday in my class, about active listening. Can you describe that exercise where you would have people listen on stage?
So, yeah, we would have different themes in level three all the time. And one of the themes that I would do is I would have, for the listening day, just the act of focusing on listening. It's like it acts like a muscle. It's not a muscle for the doctors of the room, but it acts like one. And the first thing that we tend to do is we try to listen to just a little bit of what we need to hear in order to do what we need to do. But you end up missing a huge chunk of what the other person's telling you. So just even getting people used to listening for a day is one day more of their life than they would ever actually spend listening. So one of the activities we do is we have them get on stage and everybody picks a different spot on stage, sitting on the floor. And I just have them close their eyes and listen. And I have them tell the story of what they heard as a group. And then I walk around the room with them with their eyes closed, completely naked. Not true. I wear shoes. And I walk around the room and I will make noises. Nothing so abrupt that it like scares them, but I will do little sounds in different parts of the room. And, you know, the biggest thing I would do is a chair would tip over and that would shock everybody. But if you shock them too much, they'll open their eyes. So, and then afterwards I would just say, what did you hear? What could you hear? What came to your attention? Because all that information coming to you are jumping off points. Everything that happened, the heartbeat next to you, the person standing over here, these are all leaping off points. We always ask the audience for a suggestion, but that's to include the audience in what we're doing. We don't need their suggestion. We need a jumping off point. And a jumping off point can be anything observed. So therefore, what we do is getting to trust that, like, even the things you hear are telling you a story. The things that you can't see that are happening around you is information that can be used to jump off to something else.
And the other thing, and we covered it in the interview that I lost, was this idea when you get a suggestion from the audience, it's not just the word chocolate, it's how the word is said. If someone If you're in a an audience and somebody yells chocolate, you know, really aggressive, how is that going to affect how you use the suggestion?
Yeah, if somebody goes chocolate, you know, now all of a sudden you've got a person who's got, you know, instantly I can tell from the way that they yelled that they got a problem. They really need things. They have a an addiction problem, and now we can explore addiction. You know, what was I can't even remember the one we did in the post interview, which was like somebody I can't even remember the word was, but it was like dildo. You know, all of a sudden you can tell that person is reluctantly screwing with you because dildo is a terrible suggestion, and for them to even say it unpassionately, now they're an unpassionate person who's screwing with you, and now we can see that person in a scene. You know, we can take the tone of the way people do things. It's not necessarily doing an impression, but you can kind of read, like, if it's said in such a way that the audience had a reaction to the way something was said, that's more information to process. Because when we listen, we're not just listening for the words and the information. We're listening to understand the human need behind why someone said something in the first place. And you don't have to have someone go on for 20 minutes about their human need to get the sense from them that they have a desire for one thing or the other. We can kind of do a quick read because we don't have the time in an improv scene to sit there and listen forever. But in your everyday conversations, we do.
If you got dildo and the guy was like, dildo, like he thought he was funny, how would you metabolize that in terms of an initiation or a character or something you would do in a long form?
I'd do a character piece about a guy who is really bad at fucking with people and how he's constantly, he or she, probably he, if it's this, if I'm making a hard time, like, you know, if somebody really did that, which they don't do, we don't give a lot of reluctant dildo requests, but if they did, you know, they're asking to be kind of messed with a little bit. If I got that, I mean, dildo is such an old one that one you can almost say, thank you, I appreciate what you left behind to come to the show tonight, but we've actually gotten dildo quite a bit. I mean, there are certain words that you can't even just ignore or just not even call out. But if I had to take it, I would probably do a scene about a guy who was like, yeah, I got some other ideas of how to fuck with people. But like his ideas aren't flushed out very well, right? It's like, well, I got a brick that I'm going to put above a door. And when they open the door, the brick falls down. Maybe. And then like that gives somebody else a partner in the scene to be like, that's a terrible idea. You could kill somebody and go to jail, you know, just giving. And then they've got to get off that to what is the relationship between each other.
The other thing about you and me too, we have this in common, is that we've been doing this a long time and we're now like, we're like old men on stage.
Yeah, we are.
And when I look at pictures of me in Facebook from a show that I did, you know, you're just like, oh my God, who's that old guy up there? How do you think the audience is taking us in?
Oh, first of all, they're like, I mean, it's tough because IO audiences, for instance, aren't the same as other audiences. They're often students who are trying to learn stuff. And sometimes they're also people who are part of a social group and they know we're never going to be part of their social group. So therefore, they're kind of like, I don't really care what this person has to say. I have to admit, the first time I saw Noah play on stage, he had come back from LA, but I didn't know he had a history of playing at IO. He had been writing for Dharma and Greg and all of a sudden he came back. And I remember being in the audience being like, who's the old guy? Because in my mind, I had this stereotype of old guys being people who were late discoverers of the art form, and they were often really not great performers, and that they were kind of given breaks because it's like, well, he is 52. If we don't give him a chance to play Armando early, he'll never get a chance before he dies. And so I think I had stereotypes about old guys. And now I am one, and it's terrifying to think of what I thought and how wrong I was. But when they watch us, it's just that much more on us to then not try to stand out. I think it's really about the one thing that old guys have up on stage is the patience to see what happens. to see where it goes. Because if we have a bad show, we're not going to be head and hands backstage afterwards. We know that there's going to be another one. So that means we can find the patience to find the thing that's good in the stage, and then also have the awareness to be like, this scene isn't about me today, because I've had every improv experience that I need to have. I don't need to force it today.
What do you enjoy about improvising still today?
Boy, I enjoy surprising them. I definitely enjoy those moments when I am when they're like, who is this old guy who showed up dressed up? And the reason I show up dressed up is because I gotta go to a job from time to time. Not because I want to look like a guy trying to sell you insurance. But I really enjoy the fact that you can still surprise yourself. And I think that there in life, especially as you get older, you start to look around the room and think you know everything. You become the old dog that won't learn new tricks. And every time you go out there and improvise, you're teaching yourself a new trick. And that to me is fascinating. It's invigorating. You know, I had a fun show just even last Wednesday, and just thinking that, like, well, you can still be creative no matter how old you are or how long you've done this. That's what I still get out of it.
And how important is it to be playing with the new generation?
It is great. It's tough because it's like you start to think, you know, for instance, they're all about commitment and constantly coming back and increasing our involvement. And it's tough because you're on the other end, because it's like I no longer can take a lot of decisions that don't pay me. And so that's a challenging thing. And sometimes I fear that my inability to really keep the pace that they can keep, and when they're 20 and don't have a family and don't have a significant other and you don't have any money, so this is the place that you go to because it's something to do. Like, I don't have, those years are behind me. And so what I try to do is I try to make sure that that they can read my enthusiasm and appreciation for where they are in life, and that I don't become a distraction to them.
In this, doing this as long as we are, there's always a lot of disappointments. And I think one of your biggest disappointments had to be you had been hired at Second City and toured with them for 4 years in the National Touring Company. And you understudied the main stage for quite a while. And you didn't get hired for one of the stages, which was one of your dreams.
Yeah.
What are you doing with that now? I mean, that was years ago, but there's a part of me, because I never got hired by Second City, there's a part of me that thinks every time there's an opening on main stage that they're going to call me. And
they might.
Stop. It's weird.
Yeah, but they might, Jimmy. You never know. They may, you know, they may give you a call and they're like, we've got a new idea for comedy, and it's to get all the old guys back. I waited in the Russian bread lines. I waited for Second City, and I got to the front of that line and they were like, we have no bread. And you're like, what? I waited in the line. I did this. But the fact of the matter is that I think a lot of people get caught up in the system. They need a place to go. You know, just like when you're in high school, you're like, and then I'll graduate high school and then I'll go to college. And then you're like, okay, and then I'll graduate college and then I'll go to wizarding school. And then I'll graduate wizarding school, which is also what I call improv. And then I'll go be a wizard. At the end of the day, we get so caught up in wanting to have the formula in front of us that we don't even realize that it's not what classes you took. It's what you did with what you learned. And as much as I wanted those stages at Second City, I really did. I fought for them. I couldn't control what other people did. I couldn't control. And, you know, I don't think that it was because somebody didn't like me. I think it's just that they chose somebody else. And that was a heartbreak. And it really was. But it doesn't... nothing comes from those stages for the most part. People wait in line for them because it's the top of the Sunday. But, you know, if you've talked with anybody who's done those stages, they still usually have to go out to L.A. or New York and start all over again, just like anybody else. And it's one of those things where it reminds me that I shouldn't worry about things I can't control, because you can't control them. I would have loved to have done a stage. I would have loved to have gotten up there and created some material for them. But at the same time, I still had what are you going to do with the knowledge that you have in front of me? That question was still out there to be answered. And when I look at my friends who did the opposition, who recently got cut, I look at those guys and
you're
they took what they
Leper show on Comedy Central that just
got cut, which is a shame because they were doing pure satire. You know, they were taking the comedy they had to deal with the issues that we have in everyday life and this insanity that we're living in and try to make sense of it through an experiential way by making people laugh and maybe see things differently. I think that they were bogged down by the fact that we are overwhelmed with insanity right now, that we're forgetting to laugh. But those guys took what they learned from improv and put it to work to change people's lives, to make people laugh, to get a profit. And, you know, eventually that's where you have to go. And whether or not you got to wear the golden crown on your way out of graduation day is – it doesn't – it's just an extra thing that you can brag about maybe or talk about. But it doesn't really mean anything. It's what you do with those – with that knowledge in the real world that counts. And so that's how I kind of focus on it. Now I'm working with a lot of people. We go out to businesses. We talk about a lot of things you and I are talking about right now. And trying to make their lives better by changing their perspective a little bit. And that, to me, is entertaining and fun. And sure, I would love for somebody somewhere in Tallahassee to be doing a Shad Kunkel scene. But still, I wouldn't know about it. And I wouldn't, and there really wouldn't be any, they certainly wouldn't be getting any residuals from it. So, you know, at the time, it was a heartbreak, but I had to drop my agenda because that was just my preconceived notion of how my life was supposed to be. And that's in the spirit of improv.
So we got to wrap this up. We asked the same question at the end of the podcast. What one piece of advice you would give to somebody starting out in improv today?
Well, and I think I said this last time, but I'm going to add something to it this time, which is that... first of all, stop beating yourself up, whoever you are.
Are you talking to me?
I might be talking to you, Jimmy, to this day still.
Yes.
You can't be a dictator to yourself as you learn a new art form. Imagine if you were, when you were a little kid, yelling at yourself every time you fell down. Imagine if you were, when you were learning how to talk, you would, you know, beat your head on the wall every time you didn't say it correctly. You got to let yourself fail, man. You got to take the person who takes credit for everything and have them take a back seat. And if that means you got to meditate, if that means you got to, you know, stand by a waterfall and pray to a crystal, fine. But get you out of it and let the doer do. And then remember, in the long run, and this is from TJ Jagodowski when he told me, he's like, there's enough room for everybody. There will be room for you wherever you got to go. Your happiness will be found if you keep pursuing it. And someone else's success is not your failure. So those three things are the advice that I would throw out there.
Chad Kunkel, thank you so much for being our guest. Did we get enough name dropping in there?
I don't know if we did. I mean, let's face it. I could talk about The Reckoning and I could talk about, I mean, I'm sitting here next to Art Garfunkel. So is that a fun name drop right there?
That'll work. I'm just going to check that off. So that makes 10 for this episode. And I think we covered jealousy. I think we covered everything. I love you. I've always loved playing with you and hopefully we'll get to play soon.
I love you too, Jimmy, but you still owe me $200.
Okay. And what was that for?
I can't remember. I just have anger written down under Jimmy owes me $200.
Okay. So you've been sitting with a resentment for a while then.
Yeah.
I appreciate you doing this. I wish we would have talked about this at the beginning. I'll look. Do you have a receipt or anything?
No. Just anger, reasons to be angry. Mm-hmm. And Jimmy Recurring owes me $200. It's on my list.
Okay. Do you have a whiteboard in your office where you got like it's like $200 and then owes you $20 and you circle that with another feeling?
Just listed, just it's a whiteboard next to just a batch of weapons.
Okay, great. That's not too scary, is it?
No. The two have nothing to do with each other.
Okay, great.
Yeah. Great. Those are for practice.
Great. And you don't know where I live, so that I don't have anything to worry about.
No. It's true. That's all true. Right. I'll just wander the streets yelling, Jimmy, and find you that way.
The sad thing is, I would probably respond.
Yeah, you would.
Because I'm that sad. Thanks again. This has been great. And you know, no, I'm so honored that you're willing. This is like we did a pre-interview and then we did a regular interview that I didn't get. And now I got this recorded one. You've actually done more episodes than Improv Nerd. There's only one that's going to air. And I really want to thank you.
I'll do it again. If you forget this recording, I'll jump on and do it again. It's just fun to talk to you, Jimmy.
Me too. And hopefully we will get to work together soon. Okay.
All right.
Take care. Thanks so much.
There you have it. Another great episode of Improv Nerd. I want to thank our guest, Shad Kunkel. And I love those two exercises he gave us. And that is the one, the listening, the 5 minutes where he walks around and makes noises. I tried that in one of my classes and it went really well. And also the dancing one, which I'm going to try. I just have to figure out how to get the music together. So I really love those both, really very much. I want to thank my producer, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you wouldn't be even hearing my voice right now. Also, if you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning classes, workshops, and summer intensives, go to my website, jimmycorain.com. Also, follow us on social media. There's so much social media out there. But our Facebook page, Improv Nerd, like us, because it really helps with my low self-esteem. Follow us on Twitter, which is Improv_Nerd, and then our YouTube channel, which is Improv Nerd Podcast, all one word. And also, don't forget our ongoing Patreon subscription page, where we release videos every month to make you a better improv teacher. They're like master classes to make you a better improv teacher. And we also release a full episode, a video episode of Improv Nerd, and that's just $10 a month. So we really could use your support. All you have to do is go to Patreon/Improv Nerd to subscribe. And of course, I want to thank you for listening. I couldn't do this without you. I really appreciate it. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run. Nerd is a nerd.